Today is September 13, 2010. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. We're here for an interview with Nell Minow from the Corporate Library. I'm Tom Stanton of the FCIC staff with a frog in my throat. Excuse me. And maybe we should go around the table, but first, Nell, is it okay with you that we're taping?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so if you say your name for the record, and then Alexis Minow.
Okay, my name is Nell Minow, N-E-L-L-M-I-N-O-W.
I'm Alexis Simendinger, S-I-M-E-N-D-I-N-G-E-R, with the FCIC writing team.
Welcome. We look forward to your insights on governance.
Thank you.
While I clear the frog out of my throat, I was wondering if you might share with us your perception of the financial crisis from the governance perspective.
Certainly. Well, as you may know, the corporate library rates boards of directors like bonds, A through F, in terms of the risk that they pose to the organization, investment risk, litigation risk, liability risk. We actually have two different ratings, but for the purposes of this conversation, I'm going to stick with just our core rating. And we rated all of the bailout companies poorly for 2 years or more before the meltdown, because in large part of the way they structured their incentive compensation, which seemed to us and continues to seem to us to be an indispensable element of risk management. And to put it as simply as possible, but I think accurately, really everyone at every point in the financial system was getting pay that was all upside and no downside. And for that reason, all of the risks were externalized ultimately onto the taxpayer and the economy as a whole. So, for example, if you're going to pay the subprime mortgage originators based on how many transactions they close rather than on the quality of those transactions, the outcome will inevitably be high volume and low quality. And that was exponentially applied with regard to the origination of the derivative instruments. So they too were being paid based on the number of loans rather, or number of securities rather than on the quality of those securities. And therefore, you know, it was just one big vicious circle. Another example that I can give you is Bear Stearns. Normally, we look at incentive compensation. They will say incentive compensation will be based on the following metrics, and in some cases it's as few as one metric, which if it's the right metric is absolutely fine, but it certainly it does tell you something about what the company's priorities are, whether intentionally or unintentionally. In the case of Bear Stearns, they listed 9 metrics that would support the incentive compensation, and they were the obvious 9. They were the 9 that you might ask in first year business school class to come up with. However, at the end of the list, it said that it was within the discretion of the board of directors to award 100% of the bonuses based on any of the metrics. So that's your basic throw the dart at the wall, draw a target around it kind of incentive compensation. You know, it's like a pinball. Anything you hit is going to ring a bell, and therefore you're not sending any kind of a clear signal to your employees about what is required. Furthermore, just the very volume, the very amounts of the pay really subverted any kind of incentive direction. You could say that Dick Fuld lost $800 million when his company folded, and that would be that's too bad. But he was left with $300 million, $200 of which was not disclosed until a whistleblower in the company made it public. And therefore, it's unlikely that his he had too many sleepless nights over that. The diminishing marginal utility of pay at that level is in itself a risk factor. So that's my sort of general overview. I have some information here, but there are two other points I want to make. One is that I think it's really crucial that you look at the other parts of this system to figure out what went wrong. you know, we speak a lot about Bear Stearns paid this amount in bonuses. It's the board of directors, and I really want to focus on the members of the compensation committees, some of whom are serial offenders. And it's unthinkable to me that so many of the directors who served during this period continue to serve, and there's no consequences whatsoever. So I think it's really, really important that we look at the board of directors, and I think it's really important that we look at the shareholders. So I brought you a couple of reports here. We issue a report every year on basically who the enablers are of CEO pay. So we all know that it's the board of directors and the companies and the compensation consultants, but who is it who votes in favor of these things? Well, very often, it's the companies themselves. If you're, you know, one of the problems of too big to fail is that it's too big to succeed, because you've got different entities within one corporate structure that is far too complex for anybody to know what anybody else is doing. So if you look at the mutual funds and you see how often they vote in favor of pay packages that are clearly contrary to shareholder interests, you have to say to yourself, well, who operates these mutual funds? And gosh darn if it isn't the exact same organizations, the exact same financial institutions that are in this mess. So I brought two copies of our two most recent reports showing the extent to which the shareholders vote contrary to what would be in their obvious interest with regard to pay. So even, say, let's go back to Bear Stearns, which is an absurd pay plan and should have been a big red flag. Securities analysts don't look at this, and investors don't look at it. And so the role of the shareholders, I think, the complete failure of any kind of oversight from shareholders, which is the foundation of the idea of capitalism, either with regard to voting against these directors or voting against these pay plans, I think is a really, really crucial element. So
that's great. And now that I've gotten rid of the frog in my throat,
okay,
let's go back to the beginning.
Sure.
And tell us a bit about the corporate library.
Sure.
And then we'll ask you some questions based on what you just talked about.
Sure. The corporate library is 10 years old. We're starting our 11th year, and was the in-house research operation of an investment firm that operated from 1990 to 2000 as an activist investor. We would invest in underperforming companies and then use corporate governance initiatives to get them to improve their board and management.
What was the company?
That company was called Lens, L-E-N-S, all caps. Lens Investment Management. And we invested in about, I think it was about 22 companies over the course of the 10 years, and outperformed the market during the 90s, which was a high bar, and sold the company in 2000 and spun off our in-house research, which was really the part we enjoyed the most. So we started it with a background in looking at what I would say a governance value gap, and looking at what was going on in companies and trying to figure out why one company in a particular sector was lagging. So our clients, we developed a comprehensive rating system for rating. I think we have about 3,300 companies that we cover now. We merged in July with a company that does international ratings of corporate governance, so I don't know exactly what our number is now, but we do international companies too, but about 3,300 U.S. companies. And we look basically at those areas where the shareholders and the executives might have a conflict of interest. Shareholders want pay to be more variable. Executives want pay to be less variable. So who's in charge of arbitraging that gap? It's the board of directors. If they can't get that right, if they can't say no to the CEO on something like the guaranteed bonus, then they're a high-risk board. So we look at financial reports. We look at acquisitions, all the kinds of really core strategic decisions that the CEO succession, the core decisions that the CEOs have to make, and we do a ton of back testing to make sure that things that just seem intuitively obvious to us actually do relate to risk. We have a substantial portion of our revenue comes from director and officer liability insurers who believe that our ratings are a good predictor of litigation and liability risk. And, of course, our bad ratings on all the financial institutions before the meltdown really helped our reputation there. We also do a lot of work for law firms, headhunters, and investors.
Great. And tell us, please, your role.
I am chairman of the board and co-founder and editor, which means I have sort of a general overview of the company.
And who's your other co-founder?
Robert Monks, Robert A.G. Monks.
Great.
Did anything like this exist before you started doing it?
No, not really. Of course, we would say nothing like this exists now, except for us, but that's not true. We do have competition. Bob Monks and I, Bob Monks founded Institutional Shareholder Services, which became Risk Metrics, and I joined him there shortly afterward. So pretty much everybody in this field either is us or used to work for us.
Okay, that's good. All right, let's understand if we can break out some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you mentioned compensation consultants.
Yes.
Why is that an issue, whether a company outsources this kind of development of metrics or keeps it in-house?
Almost universally, they do outsource it, and since nobody ever got fired for suggesting that the executives make more money, it ratchets up. Compensation consultants have the Lake Wobegon approach, where all the children are above average, and their primary goal is to find some way to support your making more money so that you will hire them. And so they rely very heavily on what they call peer groups, although there's a lot of elasticity in terms of deciding who is your peer. And not very much in terms of performance.
Do you rate, you started by talking about paying originators on volume rather than quality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you rate originators, or do you primarily rate the investment banking level of them?
We can only rate boards of directors based on the publicly available information about the top executives' pay. So we don't do that, but we look at that information when we can get it.
Meaning you will look at an investment bank and see the basis on which they are compensating the originators.
If it's a publicly held company. We only rate publicly traded
right.
companies, yes.
So where would one get that? I'm thinking of the commission trying to look at that kind of question.
That's why I said we only rate based on the publicly available information, which is about the top five highest top five officers. And you know that the SEC originally wanted them to disclose the top five highest paid, and the companies all squawked and said, we don't want to do that, because they didn't want to give out that information. So we get information on what the CFO is paid and the general counsel is paid, because they're officers, when we would much rather know what the desk guy is getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
My
proposal about that, what I would like to see is that, and I feel really strongly about this, that we need the biggest gap in what we understand about incentive compensation. We should see aggregate for anybody who gets paid more than half of his income in the form of incentive variable compensation. For anybody who's in that category, we want to see aggregate figures. We don't have to have person by person, but aggregate figures and what the performance goals are, so that we can rate the risk factor in the way that the pay is structured.
When did the SEC make this decision?
When they first when they first started requiring the disclosure of pay, so that's many years ago, they wanted it to be the top five highest paid, and the companies all complained. And what they call the Katie Couric problem, you know, that we, you know, who cares what Katie Couric gets paid? But that's just ridiculous. That's a red herring. What we do want to know is, to the extent that people are getting incentive compensation, what it's based on and what the aggregate number is.
So that would have been 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, we want to have more information about, there are two things that I think are indispensable in a pay plan. One is clawbacks, and not maybe appropriate clawbacks, but actual automatic clawbacks. And you know, again, companies will complain that that's too hard to do, but these are people who are very good at math. I don't think that that's really a problem for them. I think that you know, there are a lot of different ways you can go about it. And the other thing is indexing. And this is, it seems to me, where the compensation consultants completely fail, because they never put this into place. There is no way that people should be paid on what the market does. You should only be paid on how you do vis-a-vis the market. So if it's during the 90s and the market is going crazy, and the market goes up $10 and your stock goes up $8, you should not get a bonus on that.
Okay, great.
Can I ask, are there any sure. companies that you know of who have tried to swim against the tide to do any of the things that you have recommended?
No.
So
I mean, there was a company. I mean, there's always somebody who wants to try something. There was a company years ago that did index their options. The tax code makes it a little harder to do that. I've spoken with people in the Treasury Department about it, and they have no reason for it. It just, you know, they're willing to change it, and they should change it. They just haven't. Nobody's pushed them to do it because companies don't want to do indexing of options. And certainly, and this is, again, this is this lowest common denominator effect that you get from the compensation consultants. That's exactly what they do. You know, they come in and they say, well, everybody in our field gives straight grants and not indexing, and everybody in our field, so it must be okay. So, you know, it's
the lemming.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, everybody, it's like some horrible high school where everybody just follows what the cool kids are doing.
Let me ask a variant on Alexis' question. Mm-hmm. Some large financial firms did better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see a difference in their compensation schemes compared to the others that didn't do well?
Not materially, no. No. They were all structured very similarly. I did bring you one other thing, which I have to give you on background because it's just a rough draft. But we did a very extensive report on the different, on all the financial institutions and on their pay and how it affected their risk. And so that's a better answer to your question, but it's still a draft, but I'm going to give it to you anyway.
Thank you. Great. Okay. That would be interesting. But basically,
there are some, I mean, you could say, well, Bear Stearns had that idiotic pay plan that I described, and they certainly did the worst.
Mm-hmm.
They were terrible, but I don't know. I think that was, I think that difference was almost incidental. I think that if Goldman Sachs had that same kind of idiocy, would they behave differently? I don't know. It's hard to say. But I think that that none of them had these two elements that I'm talking about, which if they had, they would not have gotten into trouble. If they'd had serious clawbacks and indexing, they would not have taken the risk that they took.
And explain that. Elaborate on that.
Okay. Well, clawbacks mean that, and by the way, I first learned about clawbacks because that's how we got paid when we were at Lens. We said to our clients, we will get paid a percentage of our performance over the market, and if the following year we lose money, we'll give the money back. That makes perfect sense, because if you don't have clawbacks, then you have no reason to think about the future consequences of your behavior. If you don't have clawbacks, then your incentive ultimately is to make the numbers as appealing as possible this year, get your bonus, and leave. There's a very fine line between making the numbers look pretty this year and actually perverting the numbers. So clawbacks are the only way to put long-term considerations into a pay package. You can say, well, you have one kind of stock option that only kicks in after 10 years. I don't think that that's as effective. I think you want to look every year as to what this is going to mean 6 months from now, a year from now, 18 months from now. And I think that for that reason, clawbacks are very important. And with regard to indexing, as I said, the stock market is going to go up, the stock market is going to go down. What you care about is how you do vis-a-vis your competition in your sector. And nobody, it's just a windfall profit for you to make money based on how the market as a whole or your sector as a whole is doing.
As one of our firms that we interviewed said, the difference between making rain and standing in the rain.
Yeah, I like that. That's exactly right. And or the rising tide that lifts all the boats. Mm-hmm. And what you want, you know, I had a chance to interview Warren Buffett earlier this year, and he told me something that he often says, which is that when for his number one requirement for his portfolio companies, that they're constantly widening the moat between themselves and their competition, and that is, how do you create an incentive for them to do that? Well, it has to be by getting them to look at those. I got a call once from a reporter who said who read me a pay plan that just sounded atrocious. And because the company had lost money and the CEO was making quite a bit of money. So it turned out that it was the CEO that I knew. So I said, I'll call you back. So I called him and I said, what's the deal? He said, I'm going to explain the policy behind my pay plan, and if you disagree with me at the end, you go ahead and tell that to the reporter. I said, okay. He said, I'm in an industry with only three players. It's not the auto industry, it's another industry. So I'm in the industry with only three players. We're all having a bad couple of years. I'm having a much better couple of years because I hedged this, and I did this, and I took out insurance on that, and I did this. And he said, I am way, way, way ahead of the two competitors. I said, okay, that's good enough. That's fine. So I'm in favor of paying people, even if the company's losing money, as long as they're losing a lot less than their mm-hmm. competition. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what you want them to do. You want them to be competitive. You want them to think about the long term. And so that's why indexing and clawbacks are required.
Let me understand clawbacks. You mentioned the danger was that somebody makes a bonus 1 year and then leaves.
Yes.
Did we see any evidence of that in the financial crisis? Or were they simply making bonuses year after year but not leaving?
They were making bonuses year after year, or sometimes they would make a bonus and then go to one of the other Wall Street firms.
So everybody was just standing in the rain.
Yeah, that's right. They were, or you know, they were dancing to the music.
Do you look at any other aspects of governance besides compensation?
Yes, we do. But first, let me tell you a little bit what we don't look at, okay? Because, as I said, there are things that seem intuitively compelling, but in reality are not. And this is one of the things that that separates us from our competition, that is our moat. And that is that many people who are in this industry look at what I call structural indicators, including, for example, how many independent directors there are, and whether their governance policies are on their website, whether their directors go to take classes, things like that. And those things all sound like they would be really good things, but they really aren't. There have been over 200 academic studies that have failed to demonstrate any benefit whatsoever from having independent directors. That's not because independence is not important. Independence is very, very important. It's because we have no idea how to judge independence of a board based on the information that is required to be disclosed by the SEC. So I'll give you just one quick example. I was at an annual meeting. And annual shareholder meeting, I got up and I said, okay, fellow shareholders, I would like to introduce you to the board of directors. We have the CEO, the CFO, the company's lawyer, the company's investment banker, and another guy. Other guy, stand up, tell everybody here what your connection is to this company, because I don't believe this is the kind of company that has independent directors. And he got up and he said, oh, my SEC filing, I'm very independent, blah, 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 blah. He was on the CEO's jazz band. He was in the CEO's jazz band. So, and even if he wasn't in the CEO's jazz band, that was not the kind of company that had independent directors. And you cannot tell how independent somebody is by the disclosures in the proxy.
There seems to be a split in governance philosophy between Americans and Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
The Europeans seem to say, excuse me, we are happy to have inside directors who
yes.
know something.
Right.
We will eagerly trade off for competence.
Correct.
Versus having outside directors that come once a month or once a quarter, whatever it is, devote a little time, but they have other activities and don't add a lot of value to the quality of decisions.
Right, and in Germany, they're both. They have two boards.
Right.
And sure, there are a lot of different ways of doing it, but remember that in the UK, for example, which in a way is the most like our system, in a way is the most unlike our system. In the UK, the Cadbury report came out in the 80s, and at that time, it was prevalent that the majority of directors were insiders or affiliated in some way. And the Cadbury report said, well, okay, that's fine for the reasons that you've just listed, but you got to have a little bit of independence, so how about if we make the chairman independent? And over the period of the 80s and 90s, they went from almost no independent outside chairman to almost universal outside chairman. Now, in the U.S., again, no study has demonstrated any benefit from that because, once again, we have no idea who is and is not independent. Michael Dell decides he's going to quit being CEO and just be the chairman of the board. He's listed as an independent outside director. That's ridiculous because then he changed his mind and went back to be CEO again. That's idiotic. So very often in the U.S., the outside chairman is the former CEO or the founder or something like that, so we don't know. I think that, of course, as I said, it's intuitively compelling. This is America. We're formed on independence. We love independence. Independence is great. And a lot of the post-Enron reforms were focused on independence. The problem is actually achieving it. And, you know, there are certain people who are independent in that they have no relationships with the CEO or the company. However, they don't have that independence of spirit. And I think that very often the kinds of people who serve on boards are, they always say we're looking for consensus builders. Well, you know, you get a bunch of consensus builders and they are always going to look around the room to see if somebody else is going to object. And that's the problem. The problem is there is no such thing as independence as long as management controls who's on the board, period.
Well, let me go back then to the European versus American approach. Assume for a minute we had genuinely independent chairs of the board.
Mm-hmm.
Would you then be comfortable with inside directors?
Well, fortunately, I don't look at the insiderness for the reasons I just said. We look only at the outputs. So I'm not a design standard person. I'm a performance standard person.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you a lot more about the independence of the board by looking at the pay plan than I can by looking at the resumes of the directors. So I have no problem. What I want to see is, to me, independence is having some mechanism, as we now do have in Dodd-Frank. We'll see if anybody takes advantage of it. Of having some way to replace these directors. You know, as I said, it's an outrage that these directors of these financial institutions continue to serve. There's something just fundamentally wrong with that. And who is in the position to replace them?
Tell me, to explain for the record, why the marketplace snaps them up, gets them as consultants. Their bios, when I go looking, have been wiped clean. Sanitized of the years that they were with the failing company. Tell me why this marketplace is still eager to get them.
Because the executives want the familiar and the people that they know that they can count on, the people that they know will not ask hard questions, will not insist on on difficult standards of performance, will not question their country club memberships or you know, they CEOs always say, we want consensus builders. Well, when you get 11 consensus builder and one dynamic leader who controls all the information and the tenure of the directors, it's a recipe for disaster. You know, that's where you get, you know, Mark Hurd, who, you know, just as you know, was fired from Hewlett Packard, his contract that they agreed on when they brought him in said that all of his first year performance goals were deemed to have been met. You know, that's Alice in Wonderland stuff. That's just crazy. Well, if you're going to say that on the way in, then no wonder you're going to bungle his departure on the way out. These are just, you know, these are just serial offenders. And I think most of them are very capable, honorable people, these directors, but we're putting them into a structure where their, you know, their IQs fly out the door the minute they sit down around the boardroom table, because they're selected by management, they're informed by management. That, I do like the idea of a genuine outside independent chairman, but as long as management's picking him, he's not independent.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to the outputs. Mm-hmm. What do you measure as outputs of a good governance system or of a governance system, and then you rate them whether they're good or not?
Well, one good thing to look at is, as I said, is acquisitions. 70% of acquisitions don't add value. CEOs have a huge incentive to do acquisitions because they're fun. They're much more fun than operations. And investment bankers laugh at their jokes and you know, tell them that they should be in charge of a much larger organization and they've got vision and all that. So they're always, their incentive is always to conquer new worlds. And boards just, if 70% of them aren't adding value, then boards are just approving too many of them. They're not, that's a good measure of independence, is if you can say no to the CEO on an acquisition. Very, very seldom happens. When it did happen, say at Coca-Cola, the CEO's tenure was truncated as a result. You know, he just could, you know, they don't want that from boards. So that's a good one. The financial reports, again, that's where the board is there to arbitrage the gap between the CEO, who wants the numbers to be smooth and pretty, and the investors, who want the numbers to be revealing and meaningful. And so if the financial reports are not investor friendly, that's another good thing to look at. Section 404 disclosures. You don't have to say that all of your internal controls are up and running. You can say that you have a problem, but you should, you know, some 404 disclosures, they'll say, and here are the six things we're doing to fix it, and we're going to be done with this one by this date. You know, they're on top of it. They give you a sense of confidence. And again, that's something where you can get a flavor of the board. Too many of the disclosures are boilerplate. They're written by the same law firm over and over and over. So things like the charter of the compensation committee, the charter of the audit committee. You know, you can go to the National Association of Corporate Directors, and they'll give you the wording for that. So you know, we don't look at that as much, but we look at, as I said, at the decisions the board makes and the crucial areas where their job is to say no to the CEO.
Do you know of any major financial firms in the decade leading to the financial crisis that said no to their CEO?
No. No. Very, very, very few boards of any kind say no to their CEO. We don't give them any A's.
Okay.
And when we do give A's, very often, this is not intentional, but as I look at patterns among the people who get high grades from us, very often it's the founder, because those people are vitally concerned with making the company work and really, really committed to it. And often their pay is fairly low because they have a lot of stock and they really care. And also another reason is that it's a lot easier to have a good tight governance system in a new company than an older established company. They tend to get much more bureaucratic and institutionalized, but a company that has only been public for a relatively short time, so the founder is still alive and involved, tends to be a little more vigorous.
to ask a process question about compensation. Should the chief risk officer of a company have a say in the structure of the compensation plan?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And the risk committee of the board should be very much engaged in.
So that's a process area where you think it very important.
Yes, I do. But again, I don't think that really exists right now. And as I said, the securities analysts should look at compensation as a key indicator. And as far as I can tell, none of them do. And every once in a while, the New York Securities Analysts Association will ask me to come give a talk, and I tell them that, and it just they don't do anything about it.
Can you tell if do you look at the turnover among the risk managers?
No, we don't. That's a very good question. We do sometimes look at the turnover of top executives because it's a risk factor for the CEO. But that's a good idea.
Do you see any difference in the way compensation or other variables you think are important are dealt with in financial firms versus, say, manufacturing firms?
We do talk about that in this draft report that I'm giving you, and we compare it. But frankly, I think they're very, very different. If you look at the people at that top echelon of pay, there's not a lot of similarity in terms of risk management between oil companies, entertainment companies, and financial firms, which are pretty much the top of the list.
I didn't understand. There shouldn't be, or?
There's not a lot of similarity. I mean, if you look at the people who are making the most pay right now, that's who it is. It's entertainment companies and oil companies. Oil companies, I would put in the category of standing in the rain. It'd be hard to not make a ton of money in the oil business right now. And as far as I'm concerned, they're all hideously overpaid. But their pay is, if tomorrow somebody invented some kind of green system and oil was no longer needed, they would all. There's some variability there. They all and in the entertainment industry, of course, there's huge amount of turnover and it is more tied to performance. So I don't think of the dollar amounts, those guys are their peers. But I think the way the pay is structured is very different.
Well, let's look at energy versus finance. From a risk management perspective, one suspects that BP had a lot of similarities.
Right.
With Bear Stearns, or
right.
Lehman, or choose your financial firm.
Mm-hmm.
Any sense of that and sort of the commonalities in governance?
No question that the risk issue is in any industrial company is very similar to the one in the financial institutions, because let's just assume for the moment that this is true, that BP shortcutted a lot of their safety mechanisms in order to make certain financial goals. Let's assume that that's true. I think it probably is. Again, my points about the clawbacks and the indexing come into play, because if they knew that that they would be responsible in the following year for the consequences of any risks they take, then I think they would make a different decision. You don't want anybody in a public company to be so risk averse that you might as well be investing it all in T-bills. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you do want to prevent them from externalizing essentially what we have now, which is that they're privatizing all of the upside and socializing the downside.
It occurs to me that there may be, at least in the financial sector, two kinds of risk. One kind of risk is where the firm, for example, increases its leverage,
mm-hmm.
and that rewards shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
So that after 10 years of supernormal profits because of excess leverage, if the firm drops off a cliff,
mm-hmm.
the present value of that last year is so low that shareholders have been really rewarded.
Right.
Versus the other kind of risk.
The goose that lays a golden egg has been killed, but you've had a lot of golden eggs in the meantime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How does one deal with that as a governance issue, or is it a governance issue?
I think that is a governance issue, especially when you consider that it's not the same shareholders. You know, so investors who relied on the information that was available and made a wrong decision when the music stopped, you know, are pretty much stuck. And you can say, well, everything was disclosed. You could have looked at the financials and seen how highly it was leveraged. You should have known better. And to an extent, that is correct. But, you know, that really just goes to the issue of what they were supposed to be able to know. That's one of the big problems that you have in dealing with these consequences, is that very often the shareholders who are taking the hit are not the ones who got the benefit. And it's hard to... And that goes particularly with regard to fines. The shareholders are taking the hit on the fine, and it's just unfathomable to me that the executives themselves, that's another way of looking at clawbacks, the executives themselves had no consequence. But I think that, you know, that's where you want to look at two things. One is, again, the failure of the institutional investors, because it's really their job, it is their responsibility in the world of corporate governance to make sure that there's sustainable growth in a company. And the institutional investors, the largest group of institutional investors, of course, is corporations themselves through their pension funds, and then the public pension funds. Those are people who average 30 years between the day a dollar comes in and a dollar goes out. So why they can't be a good financial infrastructure to ensure this kind or to promote this kind of long-term thinking, I don't know, but that's what it should be. And one of the things, just to go off on a tangent for a second, one of the things that frustrates me a lot is that as the Treasury Department and the, you know, Council of Economic Advisors, whoever are working on these issues, they never include the Labor Department. They think of the ERISA program as a benefits program, as a capital markets program, and no one ever, and the Labor Department has been silent on this. Their people are, they should be very, very much involved in this, because all it would take is for a few little tweaks on their part, and you would have this kind of strong financial infrastructure who would be monitoring.
You're talking about over time the Labor Department has had this profile? How long?
This would be ERISA.
The ERISA, yeah.
Right. But how long, what period of time are you talking about?
Well, ERISA is, what, 30 years old?
Right. So we're talking about a long-term.
Yeah. And it's the largest collection of investment capital in the world, and they have control over it. And as I said, people think of it as a benefits program. It's really a capital markets program, and nobody includes them in these conversations. And they have done nothing to address these issues.
I need to understand the goose and the golden eggs in that context. Because at least, assume I'm a long-term investor, don't I want to put at least some good part of what I'm investing in golden eggs rather than geese? And in other words, will this correct the problem, or do some shareholders in fact benefit from the eggs until year 10?
Sure they do, and that's what markets are all about. You want to have that. That's where the issue is the clarity of the financial reports and the accountability of the board of directors, so that you know what you have. Just like you can, you know, if you're going to have any kind of investment portfolio, you're going to diversify. You're going to have some short term. You're going to have some high risk. You're going to have some annuities, or you're going to have whatever, T-bills. Yeah, of course you want to have that. You just want to make sure that you're putting your money in what you think you're putting your money in.
Let's go back to the board of directors if we can, please.
Sure.
Adam Smith wrote about weak boards in the finance field.
He thought it was inevitable.
Yeah. In the finance field, Walter Badgett said the same thing in Lombard Street.
Yep. Oh, I've got a lot of great quotes about bad boards of directors. There's a wonderful one from Agatha Christie, of all people.
Go ahead and put it on the record.
I'll have to send it to you. She did something like, Coot got me in as a director of some company or other. And you go to some meeting, and someone recites a speech just bristling with figures, and you often get a jolly good lunch out of it.
Or Lord Miners in England.
Lord Miners, yes. And, you know, the parsley and the fish. There are a lot of great, and Trollope, you know, so a lot of people have written about boards of directors.
Okay, so what given the way they do work, and we have these repeated references to how they work, and setting aside desired or intended reforms, what are the functions of a board of directors currently? What do they do that's important?
Well, the board of directors is there to establish the overall strategy and oversee its implementation, to hire, motivate, and replace the CEO, and to oversee the financial reports, and to essentially act on behalf of the shareholders to address the issues that of conflicts of interest that Adam Smith thought were impossible to prevent, the moral hazard of using someone else's money. They're there to make sure that that all corporate activity is taken on to benefit shareholders.
Okay, and that's the theory. I'm wondering
what they actually do.
I mean, in practice, when Lehman had to go bankrupt, the board had to vote on that.
Yeah.
It was almost a formal ratification process.
Yes.
So it strikes me there is a function that boards even today perform that is needed.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, HP, the board had to fire Mark Hurd. Mm-hmm. Boards, by the way, generally do a very good job in a crisis. They call their lawyers, they get good advice, they will step up to the plate. It's trying to get them to prevent crisis where we fail.
Interesting. Any examples in the financial sector?
I can't think of any right now. If I think of any, I'll let you know.
And in general, it's because they cannot, from where they sit, see the signs of the storm coming?
They are, but they should. I mean, the signs are there. As I said, in Bear Stearns, if somebody gives you a compensation plan to sign off on that says, you know, everything we've just said is meaningful, actually isn't, you know, that should tell them. At Tyco, Dennis Kozlowski asked them to sign off on a CEO employment contract that said conviction of a felony was not grounds for termination. You know, you would think that would be a red flag.
That's actually probably more of a red flag than the Bear example.
Yeah.
Because the Bear example at least said the board had to make that decision.
That's right.
So they could assume that they were not giving anything away when they accepted that compensation plan.
Correct. But just think about that for a minute, that you're asked to sign off on a contract that says conviction of, you know, after someone didn't have a contract for 3 years, he all of a sudden hands you that contract and asks you to sign it.
But that must be, tell me that is exceedingly rare and a blip.
Well, that's an unusual example, but it's not that different from Mark Hurd saying, you know, all of his first-year goals are deemed to have been met. That's just crazy. Or the board of Enron, not once, not twice, but three times, waiving the company's conflict of interest rules, which, by the way, the interesting thing about that was that they were not idiots. They said, we're waiving the conflict of interest rules contingent on our being kept up to date on the following items, none of which ever happened. And that's what I hold them responsible for, is that when they didn't get the updates, that should have been the red flag. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when they were asked, how could you do that? They said, well, no one else said anything. And that's the problem with boards of directors, is that they're very much, there's kind of an emperor's new clothes thing happening there, where if nobody else says anything, then maybe I'm just not, you know, shouldn't be here.
Let's talk about Delaware law.
Or in Lehman Brothers, the board, you know, they had an actress, a theatrical producer, and an admiral, and not one person who understood financial derivatives.
So you would look at that in your assessment of the board,
quality? Yes, who's on the board. Right. But again, we really rely on the output. So if the actress decided to become an expert in derivatives and make a judgment, that would be okay.
How do you see the output before a company craters?
Well, all we can do is look at things, as I said, like
acquisitions.
Yeah, the compensation and CEO succession and things like that. You know, all we can do is go on publicly available information.
One other thing, I'm just curious. Do you also look at how many boards an individual or board members are serving on, so that you can?
That has changed very dramatically since Enron. It was not unusual. Particularly if you were a woman or black or a former government official, to serve on 10 boards before Enron. But it's very unusual now to find anybody. And Frank Carlucci famously served on 30 at one time. But it's very unusual now to find anybody on more than 4 or 5 boards. What I think is more important than how many boards a director is on is how many boards the CEO is on. So there's one CEO whose company was in the bottom half of his peer group and who served on 7 boards as well as being CEO. And, you know, you have to say, where is his board? His board should be saying to him, your job is here. And when we outperform the peer group, maybe we'll let you be on 1 or 2 other boards.
And the financial institutions... That would be very uncommon.
Yeah, but I'll say one thing about financial institutions. Some professors at University of Michigan did a study some time ago about the interconnectedness of boards,
yes,
and the financial institutions by far the most.
Oh.
But they also found, perhaps surprisingly, that companies that had what they would say is too little interconnectedness underperformed, because they were like taking people off the street, or they're taking their cousin or whatever, putting them on the board. So you want to have some, you want to have them as a part of the world of business. And financial institutions, I think, are the most connected in terms of their board relationships, primarily because every company does business with financial institutions. So it's hard, it's kind of like GE, it's hard not to have some connection to Wall Street if you're in business.
And does that create a self-reinforcing,
I think it does,
tribal sort of thinking?
I think it does, yes. I think it does. And then you have these, you know, these Shirley Jackson-type directors who, you know, are very, very good in their own field but have no clue what they're doing. Ruth Simmons, you know, people like that.
Let's talk for a minute about the other half of the governance equation, which is the CEO. Can you talk a little about what differentiates in your governance rating system a good CEO from one that's less good?
Well, we don't rate CEOs, we rate boards. So I can just say from my experience at Lens, before I was at the Corporate Library, I made an extensive study of failing CEOs, because that's really all we invested in. And, you know, if Tolstoy were writing about CEOs, he would say all happy CEOs are alike and every unhappy CEO is unhappy in his own way. But I will say that the one clear consistency of every failing CEO we dealt with was that they didn't want to hear bad news. They didn't, and they surrounded themselves by executives and board members who were just yes men. Another great opiner on the subject of boards of directors would be P.G. Woodhouse, who had a character called the Nodder, whose job was just to nod. And there are a lot of nodders around them. And you know, they just went to absurd lengths to insulate themselves from any criticism.
There's a British report out, I think the Walker report.
Yes.
That basically talks about trying to get more challenges from the board to the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
How does one build that in?
Yeah, the Walker report is great, and of course he thinks also that there should be a rebuttable presumption of activism on the part of investors, which I think is great. And I would love, again, that's something the Labor Department could do, and it would be great. So and I also like the British system of comply or explain, because a lot of American rules are essentially ceilings instead of floors. And
can you give an example of what this means? Sorry.
Yeah, sure. The SEC issued a rule
that had to do, I'll have to get the exact details for you, but during the takeover era, the SEC issued a rule which was intended to say, at a minimum, companies have to do the following steps in an acquisition, to be fair. And it essentially became the maximum because everybody just did that. And so what you want to do, you want to structure, I used to be a regulator myself, so you want to structure rules so that you encourage people to innovate and to adapt. So you want your rules, that's why I like the British approach, which is comply or explain. If you've got a better system for achieving the same goals, then go for it. And a lot of the post-Enron rules, the Delaware court rulings on you have to have a fairness opinion and you have to do this, you have to do that, all of those just became meaningless right away because they were just steps you followed. They were things that you checked off. They were not substantive. And so you want to say to people, for example, on the issue of having an independent outside chairman, the conference board, after Enron issued a report, which I thought was pretty good, where they said, okay, let's talk about what the problem is. The problem is that the CEO controls the agenda and controls the quality, quantity, and timing of the information that's provided to the board. Now, you tell us how you want to solve that problem. You got to pick a way, but you have to tell us how you can solve that problem. You can solve it by having an independent chairman. You can solve it by having a lead director. Nobody had ever heard the term lead director before. There was no such thing as lead director. Now, it's huge. Mm-hmm. I was just looking at the statistics. It's like 2/3 of companies now have lead directors. And as long as they address that issue, which I think is an important issue about the agenda and the information, mm-hmm. I don't really care what they call it. I think that's fine.
Is that enforceable? You know, do you think of an overtaxed regulator having to go around and look at every individual company and see, is this pro forma or is this real in terms of what they're doing?
Well, the SEC doesn't do anything like that with what the rules are now. So I would not expect that for them. But what I would expect is, again, that the market would respond to that. And the market would say, you know, there's a real lead director here. We're going to have a premium on the stock. There's not a real lead director here. We're going to consider it high risk. So I would imagine that those were the kinds of things that investors could tell the difference.
Let's talk for a minute about Delaware law.
Okay.
In 2009, Delaware Court of Chancery, I think it was, handed down the Citigroup decision.
Right.
That basically applied laws about the duty of care, mm-hmm. where directors are not liable unless there was no risk management system,
right.
or unless they ignored clear flags from the risk management system.
Right.
That's not a very high bar.
Correct. Well, the Delaware courts, as you know, they have their own perverse incentives. And the last time that they issued a strong decision contrary to corporations was TransUnion. That was, what, in the 70s? And all of the companies came in and said, you do that again, we're going to take our business elsewhere. There are a lot of states that would be happy to have our revenues. And Delaware's been quaking in their boots ever since. And so what we've had coming out of Delaware is a series of decisions like the Disney decision, Citigroup decision, which have some nice dicta and somehow conveniently always come down on the side of the directors. And I'm not in favor of going after directors all the time. However, I would like to have them. I think if you're on a company that has a failure of that magnitude, you should be debarred from ever serving as a director of a public company again. The
that
only
would
case
be a state law ruling, or in the case of a national bank or federally chartered thrift,
a regulatory, yeah, yeah. And I think that, the only directors who have ever had to pay a penny out of their own pocket without personal hand-in-the-cookie-jar corruption are, at Enron, those directors who sold their stock at the top had to disgorge their what they've made. And at WorldCom, the directors had to kick in. But both of those were in settlements. Those were not court rulings.
Also, they were probably duty of loyalty rather than duty of care kind of issues.
Yes, 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 they were.
And the duty of loyalty has a little more substance to it.
That's true, but you would think you could make a duty of loyalty case at Citigroup or at Disney.
Yeah, yeah.
So, as I said, once you get into the courtroom, you can settle and we provide, one of the things we do at the corporate library is we provide settlement materials in shareholder litigation to benchmark governance at different companies and say this is, and to get so to promote governance changes. So in other words, you don't have to just pay out money. You also have to add three new independent directors or something like that. So you can get something in settlement, but the court decisions, I have had it. I don't think that you're ever going to get anything out of Delaware. And I do not believe that this is what federalism is supposed to be about. The fact is, these companies do business throughout the country, throughout the world. They have shareholders throughout the world, and why they should claim Delaware domicile is absurd to me. Because if I'm a shareholder of a Delaware company, I really have no rights, no interest in Delaware. I can't go to the Delaware legislature and say, I'm a shareholder in a Delaware company, I think you should consider my interests. I don't pay them any revenues.
Do you know of a good law review or other article that discusses the role of Delaware in corporate law in this dynamic that you were describing?
Yeah, I've written one.
Can you send it to us?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob and I have written an MBA textbook on corporate governance, and we have a whole section on Delaware law. We're currently updating it for our fifth edition right now.
Well, it'd be very interesting if you could send us something on this issue of what we're seeing in other contexts you might call regulatory arbitrage.
Yes.
If you could send that,
sure.
That would be helpful.
Be happy to.
What we're looking at. Any CEOs, going back to that, mm-hmm. that were particularly good in the financial crisis?
I don't think I'm an expert on that.
Okay. Because we keep looking to understand, I mean, one can say, gee, the system didn't work very well in mm-hmm. a whole bunch of respects. But the more interesting question in at least a number of dimensions may be what distinguishes the ones that worked better mm-hmm. from the ones that didn't.
Right.
Do you know anybody that's been looking at that kind of issue?
Have you talked to Jeff Sonnenfeld at Yale?
No.
I think he'd be a good person to talk to. He's the world's leading expert on CEOs.
Great.
He's a great guy.
What if the question was CEOs working with boards during the crisis, effective, ineffective?
Well, we don't see that. You know, all we see is you know, what's disclosed. So that's hard to say. I have the same impression that anybody reading the newspaper would have. But other than that, I don't think I'm an expert.
There's a group in England called Nestor Advisors.
Mm-hmm.
Is there stuff to be relied upon? It's a somewhat different approach from the one you've described.
Yes, I know people who've worked with them, but I have not. So I'll have to ask the people in my company.
Okay. Is there some?
Is that Stilpon, Nestor?
Yes.
Yes. I think Bob has worked with Stilpon and feels. I'm going to be with Bob tomorrow, so I'll ask him. I think he thinks highly of him.
Any other thoughts, areas we haven't covered that we should have?
Well, I think, as I said, there's a lot of material in here. The main
okay.
thing I would say is don't let the investors off the hook. I think that the reform efforts up till now have overlook them completely, and they the fact that they have consistently acted against their own interests, they have their own agency costs. I mean, it's not their interest, it's my interest as somebody whose money they're managing. you know, I think is a huge problem. And the fact that they are located within the same financial institutions and basically took a dive on all of these issues of oversight, I think is really important.
So you're looking, I mean, the investors have clearly taken a hit. You're talking about the money managers or the fund managers,
yeah.
Basically.
Yes.
And their compensation structure.
Yes.
Are there any, we've read some, but are there other articles you might recommend to us on the compensation structure affecting fund managers?
I don't think it's the compensation structure there so much as it is the coziness. I mean, the fact is that these, as I said, these organizations are located within the same, if Citigroup or Goldman, you know, they've got funds, and how are they going to vote? They're going to vote against the pay plans at Goldman?
Well, I'm thinking more of the Fidelities or the Vanguards or
right.
Sort of broad-based funds.
Fidelity, as you know, is a private organization. I mean, there's really, you can't get any kind of information about it, but you certainly talk to Ned Johnson. He's in the past been willing to be outspoken on these issues, and we haven't heard anything from him in a long time. But where are they? Where are the, and even, you know, I mentioned the ERISA funds as being the largest block of investment capital, but you know who manages it? The same people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to give you, this is the confidential rough draft, which
now,
is
on. What does this mean? This is coming out shortly, or?
Yes.
Okay,
but
can you send us the final when it comes out?
I have
out
to
so
check with the client.
That?
I have to check with
okay.
The client. If the client, I think it should be okay, but if the client approves, certainly, and you're more than welcome to have it, and then share copies of the reports, and those are public, and you can do anything you want with them on
okay.
On who votes how, and you know who's in the tank, and who's slightly better, and who's improving, and who's not.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask a couple quick questions?
Of course, and by, you know, I live here, so I'm happy to come over any time, and I know you guys have access to our database, so.
And you had lunch with Steve.
I did.
Up on the roof.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I know. I have to come back because I didn't have my camera. I want to come back and take some pictures.
It's nice up there.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a couple quick things. Is there anything that you could add to the commission's thinking about the compensation issues or governance related to Fannie and Freddie and the ratings agencies? Anything that would be important to think about?
Well, that was a governance nightmare.
What was a governance nightmare?
Fannie and Freddie. I mean, you know, that was a duck-billed platypus in every way. I mean, that, you know, basically, I guess I would say that you can't have an enterprise that is both a government entity and a private corporation, and with regard to Fannie especially, the abuses of the foundation and the way that they played the congressman, you know, that was just an absolute nightmare.
So you're saying,
and the regulator didn't do a good job. It, you know, that was a failure at every possible level.
A recipe for it.
Yeah, you cannot make that work. You that's just a duck-billed platypus. You just cannot make it work and be a government entity and a public company and have a monopoly that gives you an advantage in competition. And have a board that is part political and part not, you know. And I met with the board a couple of times as evolved, very good, principled people who wanted to do the right thing, and it was just a disaster.
Board of which one?
Of Fannie.
When was that?
Let's see. I met with them before they got into trouble and after they got into trouble.
On their internal controls, or
yes.
On their internal
controls? On their internal controls, yeah.
They wanted your advice?
Yes. Well, I don't know if they wanted my advice, because we don't consult with companies, but, you know, I live in the area, and I thought, well, I'll go over and see what they're like. So I went over and I talked to them a little bit about what I thought good governance was, and of course, you know, they were supposed to be exemplary. They were the only people who ever, S&P only released one governance rating in its brief tenure as a governance rating agency, and it was the A+ that they gave to Fannie. And, you know, they were at that time really promoting themselves, and just inviting me over was a way of window dressing to show that they, you know, how committed they were to good governance.
You felt that at the time? They were parading you through?
Yeah, I did, because I mean it was a fairy tale. There was no governance in any kind of meaningful way because of the way that they were set up. You know, as long as a president is appointing your board members or some of your board members, it was ridiculous. And the board was huge and all of that. I don't think that it can be done.
Okay. What about the ratings agencies?
The ratings agencies should all die, as far as I'm concerned. They are absolutely the worst of the worst of the worst of the worst. And the worst part of it is that they themselves have a regulated monopoly. And again, they have a monopoly, and then they should be a utility. You know, you can't have it's the same thing with too big to fail. If you are going to be guaranteed by the government, or if there are barriers to entry, then you should be treated like a utility. If you're going to be in the market, then go ahead and compete. So as far as I'm concerned, the rating agencies are fine as long as everybody can get into that business. I would love to be in the ratings business. I'm in the ratings business, but I would love to be in their business. I could do a better job.
But wouldn't that exacerbate the race to the bottom if you had a whole bunch of rating agencies competing for issuers' business?
Well, that's why I like the Barney Frank proposal, where the investors own the ratings agencies. I think that's a better way to do it. I think that's the ultimate. But don't you think that if you're in the ratings business, if it's open to everybody and there's a race to the bottom, don't you think that the market can distinguish between, you know, Joe's rating agency and Charm School over here and S&P over here? Don't you think they can tell the difference?
I guess without stating the commission's
view, yeah, I know.
My perception would be the market didn't do a very good job with the rating agencies we have.
Because there was no difference between them. I mean, if you read, I'm sure you've read, you know, The Big Short and 13 Bankers, and there was an opportunity for Fitch to be an outlier and come down another way, and they didn't have the nerve to do it. And if I wanted to be in that business and be that outlier, there was no way for me to do it. You know, it's just ridiculous. It's the opposite of what a market is to have those kinds of restrictions. And so the ratings agencies are useless as far as I'm concerned.
And remain so.
Yes, absolutely. One of them called me up and said, we're going to tell you about all this new stuff we're doing, and it's really going to be great. And I listened to it, and I said, what evidence do you have that this is going to produce a more accurate result? Nothing. So no, I think it's awful. So you either are going to make them into a regulated utility, and you show up and you put your hand into a cookie jar and you pull out which rating agency you're going to be working with today, or you open it up.
Well, that raises an interesting question generically, not just for rating agencies. That's a question of competence. That if you put the staff of a rating agency head to head with the quants at a really good investment banking firm, mm-hmm. it's not clear that it's an even contest.
Right, right.
And the same has got to be true of the boards of directors generically that you look at. How do you promote competence?
I'm a capitalist. I believe in the market. And I think if you remove impediments to efficient operation of the market, things will work better. But right now, I mean, when I first got into this business 24 years ago, O.J. Simpson was on 5 boards and he was on an audit committee. I think today he would be seen as a risk factor if he was on an audit committee. It was a 2-person audit committee. The other guy didn't know anything about accounting either. You just never heard of him. So, you know, things have changed. I mean, and I would hope, I hoped this after Enron, but I really hope it now, that people will look at boards of directors and say, this is an actress, this is an admiral, who are these people? What are they telling us? If the CEO doesn't want to surround himself, if he's not bright enough to surround himself with people who will challenge him and bring something extra to the table, then do we really want to trust him? So I'm hoping that you know, the market will reflect that reality.
We recently had an interview with an international regulator, and I asked about governance and overbearing CEOs. Mm-hmm. And the answer that came back was one that is worth mm-hmm. quoting someplace. And that was, you know, the best people tend to be really arrogant.
Yeah. When I was talking to Warren Buffett about I was talking to him about this thing he's doing with Bill Gates where they're asking all the billionaires for their money. So I said, so how's that going? And he said that he talked to one of them. He said, now we're asking everybody to commit to give 50% of their assets away. And the guy said, what about 49? You know, that's who these people are. That's, you know, in a way, we're all enablers for that behavior. We want that kind of energy to be deployed on our behalf. And but that's who they are. He's negotiating over 1%, which is meaningless. He'll be dead by then. But that's who he is. He has to get have an edge all the time, and that's who these people are. And so it's the job of the board of directors to make sure that's deployed on behalf of shareholders and not on behalf of himself.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a couple
yeah.
of things?
Yeah.
So following up on what Tom was asking about the marketplace, you've mentioned this a couple of times about how you want the marketplace to function efficiently
yeah,
and be
right.
a regulatory power, mm-hmm. right? And we've heard former Fed Chairman Greenspan talk about this was something he didn't see, that the marketplace would not act in its own preservational self-interest, that so many people would function against their own grain. So I guess I hear you saying this, but I wonder why you have this optimism that the marketplace can do that. Can you really believe it can do that?
I do believe that it can do that. Obviously, the regulators have a role, and certainly the Fed could have done a much, much better job. But ultimately, you don't want regulators. I've been one. I love regulators, but you don't want them running businesses. You want the businesses running them, and it seems to me that that their interest is never going to be as sharp in making sure that these companies stay competitive as the people who are invested in them. And so you just want them to have those consequences. You know, at the end of Michael Lewis's book, he says the people who bet against subprime made a lot of money, but the people who made subprime made a lot of money too. That's wrong. That's not the market. That's the opposite of the market. And I think one of the things that distresses me the most is that for the very small sum of $600 million or one Angelo Mozzillo pay package, you know, the financial institutions were able to pour that into getting rid of all the regulations that would have prevented this. And so, you know, that to me is one of the is the bigger conundrum than could shareholders do their job? Yeah, I think shareholders could do their job. The bigger conundrum is what do you do when Brooksley wants to have a concept release and gets shut down because the entire economy is going to grind to a halt? And I think that even with Dodd-Frank, Wall Street has been very, very successful at keeping everything that mattered to them.
So you're marginally optimistic, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, I'm counting on you guys.
Okay.
We're doing the autopsy.
I know, but you're going to do it in a way that people will understand what they need to do in the future.
Let me ask you, going back to the beginning when Tom's first question, mm-hmm. the commission is not going to say that compensation or governance was a cause of the crisis, but they are obviously mandated to look at it as a complication, a complicating fact. What's the best way to summarize, you know, asking you to do this again for the lay person, you know, who's going to open this book, you know, and see some beautiful paragraph about this, about how this became a complication. Give me the short version of that.
The short version of it is what I just quoted from Michael Lewis. Really, that's it. That's everything. In fact, that's going to be the epigraph of the new of our fifth edition of the textbook. At the end of this process, the four people who bet against subprime made a lot of money, mm-hmm. but all the people who created it made a lot of money too.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's what's wrong. So as long as they don't have to pay any kind of penalty for failure, and as you know, they treated the bailout money as though it were revenue in terms of computing their subsequent bonuses. You know, that's just an atrocity. That's just a horrible, 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 horrible thing. And so that's it. Is that no one who was involved in this mess paid any kind of meaningful financial penalty. So clearly, I believe obviously that it was a cause. But you can call it a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine, because the cause was bad governance and the symptom is bad pay. But that's
so you do believe it's a cause?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a core,
cause. The very beginning.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Then let me ask you the next follow-on. That's naturally, if I'm a, just John Q, mm-hmm. my house has been foreclosed and I'm looking for a job, whatever, and I'm thinking I'm so mad at these people, mm-hmm. want them to all go to hell, whatever, mm-hmm. and it doesn't look to me like they've suffered an ounce.
Right.
Then the next question is, what has happened to change that? What are the trends that you see, if any, to give any of these people any who are upset,
right,
including the commissioners,
any comfort, right?
Some comfort.
There's some in that draft about some changes that have been made since. But in my opinion, it's a drop in the bucket. There still needs to be a lot more. And as I said, I won't feel none of them really are indexing, and I will not feel confident. I feel that they have a credible pay plan in place unless we have widespread indexing and clawbacks.
To force trends, does Congress have to be the force?
Congress does not have any capacity to get involved okay. in pay. They just mess it up. The last time they got involved, it poured gasoline on the fire. It was 162M. So, no, I don't think so. What they should do is, as I said...
That's the tax code provision.
Yeah, right. What they should do is free up shareholders to replace directors. There's no way you're going to solve the pay problem unless shareholders can replace the directors who get it wrong. Mm-hmm. And here I have to say, I bring in journalists. You know, journalists constantly write stories and say, General Motors is paying this and Goldman Sachs is paying that. And I said, and they always call me, you know, I'm always the I am outraged quote in the last paragraph. And I always say, please put the names of the compensation committee in there. Please put those names in. And they never do. And, you know, we have to change our thinking about that. And as I said, securities analysts have to look at pay as an element of risk. And it, you know, it just has to. But I think if they do, they will find that it's reliable. Just to give you an idea, we have an imaginary portfolio based on our ratings that consistently outperform by 400 basis points. So we're thinking about, and we've been talking to hedge funds and, you know, who want to try to run money on that basis. But that's really, you know, it's that simple. There's a lot of stuff that is out there that they can't game. They can't use accounting tricks. They can't do anything. They're either paying people the right way or they're not. Mm-hmm. And so I think if people understand that, if people take that annual issue of the Wall Street Journal where they talk about who gets paid how much and use that to determine what their portfolios are, that would be good.
I need to ask a question in that mm-hmm. regard. There's a professor at the Booth School in Chicago who talks about disparities in pay. The fact that the top gets paid so much more
right.
than the people at the bottom in a
right.
firm, or generically in the United States. You haven't talked about that at all. You've talked about the form of compensation and the mm-hmm. structure rather than the disparity issue.
Right.
Is the disparity issue a factor?
Is it a factor in risk, or is it a factor in legitimacy? I think it is. I heard of a study, I have not seen it, that looked at the disparity between the CEO and the sub-CEO officials as an indicator of risk, and I think that is compelling. There's an excellent series in Slate magazine by Timothy Noah last week about the disparity issue that I think is superb, and I think it's well worth reading. So,
let me just ask you one question. I know when Warren Buffett talked to the commission, one of the things he was asked about was compensation, and he talked about his long observation of trends. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure since you've had conversations with him, we've talked about this together, but he talked about the sort of insidiousness of CEOs becoming more and more aware of each other's
yes.
packages and
yeah.
how they feel out of hubris or value
exactly.
to create and negotiate the more exotic, the next more exotic,
right.
and that one thing leads to another in this never-ending spiral.
Can you
talk about that?
Yeah, sure. He's 100% right about that. I've written about that a lot, and that's always kind of the conundrum, is that when we ask for more and more information about pay, they say, well, then everybody's going to want the same one. The fact is, that cat is so far out of the bag, that's exactly what the compensation consultants get paid for. They get paid to come in and say, you know what he's making? You know what? You're at least as good as he is. You're just as important as he is. And so I don't think, we always call the Business Week annual issue about CEO pay the swimsuit issue, because it's very revealing, and everybody likes to read it because they want to say, what, I should be in the top quartile. Shouldn't I be in the top quartile? And that's, yeah, I think that is a huge problem, but you're not going to address it by reducing public disclosure of pay, because the compensation consultants who are in that business, that's what they do there. And so I think the way to address it is simply by, as I said, educating and empowering the securities analysts and the investors to respond more effectively to it.
Okay. So it's not that we could ever go back.
No.
Okay. And then the last thing is...
And as you know, just to give you one example, I'm sure you remember the insane revelations about Jack Welch's retirement package.
Yeah.
And the reason that that was such a sexy issue is that because they put it in his retirement package, it didn't have to be disclosed, because the SEC thought, well, retirement package is going to be a gold watch and an annuity. There's really no reason to disclose it. So they just shoveled everything in there. It didn't stop him from getting crazy pay. And you want to know what else? One of the members of his compensation committee was Lou Gerstner, the then head of IBM. He couldn't sign off on that package fast enough, because he immediately went back to his board and he said, this is now the standard, and he got the same thing. So that was not disclosed, and yet it was viral immediately.
Well, also, for the ending, could we get you to summarize your educational background, your which we put into the record?
Just, your bio.
Sure. Okay. I have a BA from Sarah Lawrence College and a law degree from the University of Chicago Law School. I spent 8 years in the government.
Where?
EPA and OMB primarily. And
what years was that?
I graduated from law school in 77, went to work for EPA for 4 years, went to work for OMB for 4 years, and then was briefly at the Justice Department on my way to joining Bob Monks. And I've been working with him ever since, first at ISS, then at Lens, and now at the Corporate Library. He and I have written 3 books together, including the MBA textbook, which is coming out in its 5th edition.
One other thing, can I ask you, I'm just really curious, do you think gender and risk in any way are allied?
I think there's a very fruitful area for research, but women who have served as CEOs and on boards have either been so anomalous or so few that I don't think there's good data on that. I would love to think that there was a difference, but for example, many of the women directors are either university presidents or former government officials, who are always red flags to us in terms of their board service, because they tend, not always, but they tend to be very bad directors, former both categories.
Government officials? Tend
former government officials. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, as a matter of fact, Bob Monks says that having a Tennessee senator on the board is a sell signal, because Al Gore Sr., Al Gore, Fred Thompson, and Howard Baker have all been on terrible boards.
Mm. Thanks for that tip.
I know.
We should talk.
Tell you, we've got a hedge fund strategy.
Yeah.